Good evening and welcome to Indie Radio News, the weekly radio news program from The Independent, a free progressive monthly newspaper and online news site based here in New York. We cover social justice movements and the issues they are fighting for, both here in the city and around the world. We are your hosts, Elia Grian and Lydia McMullen-Laird.
Beginning with headlines, about 7,000 migrants from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala are in Mexico deciding whether to continue their walk to the U.S., while Donald Trump continues to threaten the migrants. Here he is over the weekend at a Make America Great Again rally in Elko, Nevada.
The Democrat Party, and it's openly inviting millions of illegal aliens to break our laws, violate our borders, and overwhelm our nation. The Democrats want caravans. They like the caravans. A lot of people say, I wonder who started that caravan.
Playing to his base, Trump tweeted, every time you see a caravan or people illegally coming or attempting to come into our country illegally, think of and blame the Democrats for not giving us the votes to change our pathetic immigration laws. In another tweet, he blamed Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador for not stopping people from leaving their countries. Mexican authorities have asked the migrants to apply for asylum so that they can stay legally in the country for up to 45 days. Mexican President-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador suggested Sunday that the United States, Canada, and Mexico work out a joint plan for funding development in the poor areas of Central America and southern Mexico. In interviews along the journey, migrants have said they are fleeing widespread violence, poverty, and corruption in Honduras. The caravan is unlike previous mass migrations for its unprecedented large numbers and because it largely began spontaneously through word of mouth. And in international news, fallout continues over the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. A bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers are accusing the Crown Prince of directing the operation. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham said Sunday, "I find it impossible to believe that the Crown Prince was not involved." Today, German Chancellor Angela Merkel called Khashoggi's killing a monstrosity. She vowed to halt German arms exports to Saudi Arabia until the case is cleared up. Saudi Arabia's foreign minister has called the killing a rogue operation and an aberration. Meanwhile, Saud al-Qahtani, a top aide for the Saudi Crown Prince, is one of the fall guys, as Riyadh tries to stem international outrage at Khashoggi's death. On Saturday, Saudi state media said King Salman had sacked five officials over the killing carried out by a 15-man hit team. Reuters reports the killing was orchestrated by the man who runs social media for Saudi Arabia's crown prince. This was the man who masterminded the arrest of hundreds of his country's elite. He detained a Lebanese prime minister. And, according to two intelligence sources, he ran Khashoggi's brutal killing by giving orders over Skype. In the UK, nearly 700,000 people marched over the weekend to demand a final say on Brexit. This was the second biggest demonstration in the UK in a century since the Iraq War March in 2003, where more than 1 million people turned up to oppose the conflict. Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May addressed the House of Commons.
The Brexit talks are not about my interests, they are about the national interest and the interests of the whole of the United Kingdom. Serving our national interest will demand that we hold our nerve through these last stages of the negotiations, the hardest part of all. It will mean not giving in to those who want to stop Brexit with a politician's vote. Politicians telling the people they got it wrong the first time and should try again.
May said the Brexit, the plan to leave the European Union, is 95% complete.
Turning to local news, New York's Attorney General Barbara Underwood announced today that Wells Fargo will pay a $65 million penalty following an investigation into the bank's fraudulent statements to investors in connection with its cross-sell business model. It's a process of selling a new financial products and services to existing customers. It's a process of selling new financial products and services to existing customers. Employees in Wells Fargo's Community Bank Division engaged in fraudulent sales practices. This includes the opening of millions of fake deposit and credit card accounts without customers' knowledge. The Attorney General's office is also continuing its investigation of Wells Fargo's in connection with its illegal business practices of opening millions of unauthorized accounts and enrolling consumers in services without their knowledge or consent. In other news, the Community Service Society of New York found people of color comprise nearly 94% of those jailed for turnstile hopping. This is according to a new analysis of long-awaited enforcement data released by the New York Police Department on October 3rd. A black person stopped for fare evasion in Brooklyn is 30 times more likely to be arrested than a white person in Manhattan. For more on this story, go to independent.org. At City Hall today, discussions continued on the Small Business Job Survival Act. Small business owners held a news conference on the steps of City Hall. This was followed by a city council hearing on the bill sponsored by Manhattan Council Member Yidanis Rodriguez. We caught up with Richard Barr at City Hall.
Richard, could you give us an update on what's going on at the moment?
The hearing was opened by City Council Speaker Corey Johnson, who acknowledged that closing stores and empty storefronts all over the city is a big problem, and he was determined to move something forward to address it. Then he introduced the chair of the Small Business Committee of the City Council, Mark Joni, who kind of tipped his hat. He's a former small business owner and a former landlord himself, and he described the problems for small business owners as fines, fees, taxes, regulations, and competition from online retail, and that's causing small businesses to go out before they even get to a rent increase from their landlords.
And Richard, has there been a press conference held before the hearing? Were you able to attend?
A lot of community groups and individuals spoke. And one of the speakers, both at the press conference and one of the people, and she also testified a little while ago at the actual hearing, was Ruth Messenger, who, when she was city council member for the Upper West Side, before she later became Manhattan Borough President, she was the one in 1985 who first put forward this bill. It came from her office, and she still feels like the decline of mom and pop stores and the empty storefronts and everything being replaced by chain drugstores and banks is ruining the character of the city. She still feels it very much to be a big problem. She was enthusiastic for the bill.
On Saturday night, a large group of people, together with Witches of Bushwick, gathered at Catland Books to hex Kavanaugh.
And I really think that we collectively had an event where survivors were able to feel safe and that everyone could experience catharsis and healing through that.
Dakota, Catland co-owner and creator of the Hex on Kavanaugh event, told The Independent that it was not the first hex they did. They had already conducted various ones before for President Donald Trump.
All of your ill wishes and hatred, you rip off the piece of paper, you crumple it up, fold it up, put it in your mouth, I don't care, then it goes in one of the jars. After we're done, the jars get sealed, candles get burned, they just get hacked.
Outside the bookstore, other religious groups gathered as counter-response to the ritual against Brett Kavanaugh. In other news, the Trump administration wants to adopt a new definition of gender that will effectively deny federal recognition and civil rights protections to transgender Americans. LGBTQ leaders and civil rights organizations are stunned and furious and rallied outside the White House today in protest. In New York, protesters gathered Sunday evening in Washington Square Park. To talk about Sunday's rally, we have senior attorney Omar Gonzalez-Pagan and healthcare strategist at Lambda Legal Services, one of the organizations that called for Sunday's rally. Omar wasn't able to be on the phone, but we do have Sasha Bushert from Lamar Leger as a senior attorney from Lambda Legal Services. Sasha, are you with us?
I am. Thanks so much for having me on your program.
Can you tell us a little bit about how yesterday went and why you pulled the event together?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm actually in D.C. and I spoke at the rally here in front of the White House today. But I will talk about what I know about what happened with the New York rally last night. My understanding was that they met in Washington Square, and it was, you know, put together, you know, and organized by Lambda Legal and other organizations, and that it was an amazing turnout. And, you know, looking at the pictures, it looked like there were just, you know, hundreds, literally hundreds of people, and just so much energy and so much support. You know, as an openly transgender person myself, you know, it's just really gratifying to see so many allies come out and show solidarity. So I just want to say thank you to all those folks in New York that showed up last night.
Thank you, Sach. Is there any rallies taking place today or during the following week?
Yeah, there was a rally today, you know, in front of the White House that was great, too. It was another amazing turnout, and had folks, you know, from all kinds of civil rights organizations speaking out and speaking truth to power and making sure that our voices are heard about this. You know, I'm not aware of other rallies that are happening this week, but if you look on our website, you know, we try to promote them as quickly as possible on our Twitter feed at Lambda Legal.
Well, thank you so much, Sasha, for giving us this update. We look forward to hearing more from the rallies.
Oh, you're welcome.
And going today, tomorrow, Tuesday, October 23rd, marks the one-year anniversary of the Count Me In campaign, led by construction workers at the Huston Yards mega development site located on mid-Manhattan's far west side. This campaign is pressuring one of New York City's largest and most powerful real estate conglomerates to use union laborers for the duration of the project. The building trade unions were largely segregated until the 1960s, but according to a 2017 study by the Economic Policy Institute, the majority of unionized construction workers in the site are now Black and Hispanic. The non-union sector is more than half Latino and largely immigrant, many of them undocumented. Reporter Joe Maniscalco talked to Bill Carmico from hashtag Count Me In for Labor Press.
We're becoming second-rate citizens in this country. There's no respect for the working man. If everything is corporations, and this is the problem. And the real problem is that the people that own businesses don't realize that if you lose the working class in this country, they're going down too. They're going down.
This month's print edition of The Independent includes also a profile by Stephen Wishnia of the hashtag Count Me In campaign, which has been holding weekly Thursday morning rallies at Huston Yards to protest the related company's use of non-union labor at what is one of the most expensive real estate construction projects in U.S. history. Related signed a project labor agreement with the New York City Building and Construction Trades Council to use exclusively union labor in the first phase of building Huston Yards. However, it refused to do that for the second phase of the project and instead hired contractors who are using a so-called open shop, which is a mix of union and non-union workers. To talk more about hashtag Count Me In, we have Mike Hellstorm, campaign director and assistant business manager of the Mason Tenders District Council of Greater New York. Hi, Mike. Welcome to Indie Radio News.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us more about a hashtag Count Me In campaign and who is participating in it?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, Count Me In campaign is really just a Solidarity 2.0 movement here in the New York City Building Trades, which is comprised of 14 different international unions making up 100,000 workers here in New York City. And really just coming together to solidarity lines to really empower ourselves as workers and not let the, you know, the ruling class here in New York City and related state laws get away with a plan to really undermine 100 years of collective bargaining and set us all backwards in their pursuit of greed. I mean, the Huston Yards is a $26 billion project. It is the largest construction project in the United States history. This is not a money issue, you know, as far as we're concerned. It's a greed issue as far as Stephen Ross is concerned. We did the whole entire first phase, 100% union building trades, which, you know, just really creates pathways, you know, to the middle class for a whole bunch of New Yorkers, men, women, you know, Latinos, African-Americans, formerly incarcerated people that are coming back home. And in the second phase, he's got a real plan here to try to handpick and select which trades would get good unionized wages and which trades would get exploitable wages.
So how many jobs are at stake here?
Well, in the next phase, our estimate in the next phase for the second phase of the Huston Yards is about 8,000 construction jobs.
happen with the duration of the second phase.
Alrighty, and how does, going back to the Count Me In as a concept, how did the name appear, and how did it come about?
You know, really, you know, Count Me In is just an idea that it was, we're sitting around the table and we're thinking about the issues in front of us, that the really the working class has to be able to look to their counterparts and the people that are standing next to them and say, you know, if it goes down and we're going to have to stand up and fight for this, you know, where would you stand in this equation? And, you know, simply we want one worker to be able to say to another worker, count me in, because we all have a vested interest in this fight.
Thank you. Well, to all those listeners who are coming in now, you're listening to ND Radio News on WBAI 99.5. We're talking with Mike Hellstorm from the Mason Tenders District Council of Greater New York. Mike, can you describe the difference between being a unionized versus a non-unionized building trader worker in New York City? Both in terms in terms of wages and the conditions.
Yeah, I mean, as far as wages are concerned, I mean, you're talking about a 60% difference at some point. I mean, you know, if we just talk generally about, you know, a non-union, the average wage of a non-union worker in New York City is about $20 an hour with no medical benefits, no retirement plans, no sense of security other than the job itself, as compared to a unionized construction worker where, you know, the average wages are, you know, $80 plus, you know, including benefits and the like. You know, the total package is $80, which includes benefits and retirement plans. And you know, when we think about safety on the job site, recently New York City just passed a piece of safety legislation requiring, you know, every single construction worker in New York City, union and non-union, to have a basic amount of safety training before they can really go to a construction site here in New York City. And during us fighting for that bill, 43 workers perished in a period from 2016 through 2017, with 90% of them being really undocumented non-union workers.
And looking back, because tomorrow marks the year since Count Me In started.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, I think we're coming a long way in a year. I mean, tomorrow we're going to be out in the streets tomorrow now in a show of solidarity with, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 union construction workers at the end of the day in a very long march from Midtown Manhattan, Rockefeller Center in particular, over to Columbus Circle, where Stephen Ross's headquarters are related and his personal residence is at, to let them know that, you know, we're not backing down from this fight. I mean, the staying power of us is stronger than the staying power of him. We're going to see this fight through. We're going to win this fight. So we're really excited about tomorrow. We're excited about the 1 year. We're excited about, you know, all of the protesting that we've been doing here in New York City. We've done so much protesting that our movement has become a national movement amongst building trades workers across the country.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. Thank you for coming on. You're listening to Indy Radio News on WBI 99.5. Next, we'll be talking about a potentially historical trial of environmental activists here in New York with attorney and professor David Dorfman.
Climate news, the U.S. Supreme Court temporarily blocked a high-profile climate change lawsuit on Friday brought by 21 young activists who have accused the federal government of violating the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause with policies that continue to destabilize the Earth's climate system. The Animal Legal Defense Fund filed a similar case in Oregon today. The plaintiffs in the suit include scientists, nature enthusiasts, and wildlife advocates who say they fear for their safety because of the increased severity of wildfires, mudslides, and other threats. Meanwhile, in New York State, the long-anticipated defense arguments in an environmental trial are scheduled for tomorrow in Cortland Manor. Activists for the group Resist Spectra briefly halted construction of an Enbridge fracked gas pipeline through direct action in 2016. The three individuals who crawled into the pipeline, David Pablo, Rebecca Berlin, and Janet Gonzalez, represented by attorney David Dorfman, will present the necessity defense to Judge Kimberly Regazzo, claiming that their illegal actions were necessary to prevent a greater harm. The prosecution already presented their case in July, and trespass charges were dropped against three additional individuals who participated in the action but did not crawl into the pipeline. Since the action took place almost 2 years ago, Governor Cuomo's administration has released an executive summary of a risk assessment that confirms that the highly pressurized fracked gas pipeline is not safe. The pipeline comes within about 100 feet of critical infrastructure at Indian Point Energy Center, an aging and failing nuclear power plant on the Hudson River. Local residents are still calling on Governor Cuomo to shut off the gas in the pipeline. We're joined today by David Dorfman, a professor of law at Pace University and the defense lawyer for this case. David, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Lydia.
So let's start with, what is the necessity defense? And why would it be historic if your clients were to be found not guilty based on this necessity defense tomorrow?
Okay, the necessity defense is an ancient defense. It used to be called the choice of evils defense. And basically what it says is that a person is allowed to break the law in order to avert a greater harm. So New York State, in its wisdom, has enacted a penal provision, a defense by statute called 35.05. And it lists the particular elements of this defense. So we have to show not only that the harm of, an exploding pipeline and a nuclear holocaust at Indian Point, or the harm of global climate change and superstorms and tundra fires, or the harm of the public health effects of frack gas and shale gas around people who live near the pipeline. We also have to show that this harm is what they call imminent, meaning it's happening now or about to happen now. We also have to show that my clients conduct of climbing in the pipeline was reasonably calculated to stop the pipeline. And we also have to show that they kind of exhausted other legal means of trying to stop the pipeline, which my argument is they did. They were, activists who did petition drives and appeared at community board meetings and posted comments with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, did all kinds of legal First Amendment protected activity to try to stop the pipeline. So that's what the necessity defense is. And it is historic in a couple of senses. The necessity defense has never been fully litigated in any courtroom in this country, resulting in an acquittal. We have some courts, like in Minnesota recently, where the Minnesota Court of Appeals held the necessity defense was proper in a similar case that had to do with the valve turners that people may know about, where they turn valves on oil pipelines. But that case ended up in an acquittal based not on the necessity defense, but based on the failure of the prosecution to just prove simple vandalism. They couldn't prove that there was any damage to the pipeline. So the experts never got a chance to testify in that case. The acquittal in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, that's the case involving Corinna Gore and a bunch of other people who climbed down in the ditch where the pipeline was being laid. That was also resolved by just the testimony of the defendants. There was no expert testimony. Didn't have to be. The judge just ruled on the defendant's own testimony.
Right.
The two cases in New York State that had previously entertained some expert testimony was the Wyawanda 6 case. That's the one that involving James Cromwell, having to do with the CPV shale gas plant. And there was expert testimony in that case, but the judge convicted, and there's a lot of dispute as to whether this was really a fair trial.
Right.
And then
so
there was another
trial. Just to simplify
it
really quick, the necessity defense, basically, for listeners who haven't heard of this, you can imagine, like, there's a burning building and there's a child in the burning building and somebody from outside goes in and then they save the child and then they make
and
the
they
defense
trespass
that was
in order to do it.
Right. And so they're making the defense that the trespassing was necessary. And so that's kind of, what these climate activists are trying to do. What to these activists and to these community members who have been fighting against this pipeline for years before this happened, what to them is that burning building? What are they doing these actions against?
Well, the building, the burning building, for the metaphor, is the possibility of an exploding pipeline within 105 feet of the switching yard of Indian Point nuclear power plant. That's one, and that the chances of that happening, it's hard to estimate because the government and the pipeline company hides a lot of the information that would make it more predictable. We do know that pipeline explosions happen all the time, a few a week. And the incidents of pipeline explosions on the newer vintage of pipeline, the ones that have been laid in the last 8 to 10 years during the frac gas build-out, is actually considerably higher than with older pipelines. And then these pipelines... I'm sorry.
How would winning a case like this affect direct actions against climate change? How would it change things if you guys win this case tomorrow?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, this is a trial court. It's not an appellate court. It doesn't have binding precedent, but it does send a signal that has already been sent in the Valve Turner case and in the West Roxbury case, that people can do direct action, and they have a defense. They don't have to just sit, get arrested, and plead guilty. And to that extent, there's less of a deterrent and more encouragement to people to take direct action and to really put pressure on all powers that be. And I think that it'll have influence on policymakers. I mean, people can be more vigorous in their exercise of their First Amendment rights when they feel that they're not going to be able to be successfully prosecuted.
And what about the investment side of things? How might this affect, the investment side of the actual pipeline companies?
Well, to the extent that people can take direct action and, like my clients, actually delay the finishing of pipelines and really create a problem for the pipeline companies, every day of delay is a loss of money, and every bit of loss of money endangers their support by investors. We know that even with the pipeline, the AIM pipeline that my clients were protesting, they were losing money because of delay, and there was a concern about investors pulling out. That happened in the Keystone pipeline. Certain segments of that pipeline, investors pulled out. I think that, the communities and the activists who, should be exercising all of their influence, and that includes influences on banks and mutual funds and investment funds in general regarding investment in these kinds of companies, I think that could really, perhaps more effectively than government action, which seems very slow, begin to really put a dent into this build-out of gas pipelines across the country.
Well, thank you so much, David. We'll have to leave it there for today. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you for listening. You can catch us every Monday at 6 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM for all the latest from Indie Radio News. You can find this month's print edition of The Independent at our outdoor news boxes across the city and in local libraries, independent bookstores, and social movement centers. For all our latest coverage, go online to independent.org, that's Indie with a Y, and via our social media accounts. To let us know what you think of today's show, send news tips, or find out how to subscribe to the Independent's print edition, we can be reached at 212-904-1282 or contact at independent.org. Thank you so much to WBAI for hosting our show, and see you next week.
WBAI.
The United States under the Trump administration will continue to be the cleanest and most environmentally friendly country on earth.
While Donald Trump says he has a natural instinct for science, climate activists, economists, and scientists say Trump's views on hurricanes, clean air, and climate are wrong.
We'll be the cleanest. Going to have the cleanest air?
Actually, last year's air quality index was unhealthy, the highest since 2012. Soot days, unhealthy small pollution particles linked to heart and lung problems and death, increased dramatically since Trump took office.
We're going to have the cleanest water. We will be environmentally friendly.
Climate Tuesday over WBAI. Experts and activists, political analysis, environmental justice. That's all day and all night. Climate Tuesday here over WBAI New York.
So, you want funny? WBAI's comedy show will bring you funny. As a matter of fact, you will die laughing.